Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to UFO Think Tank with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Thanks to Kevin MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod. Some awesome royalty-free music that he puts on the internet. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us once again at UFO Think Tank Radio. And boy, are there some big changes. And boy, am I excited. And you people are going to love this. Not only am I going to bring you my radio show as usual, but we are pumping it up, and it's like, you know, the difference between some little scrawny guy, which is what we got going now, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, get your ass to Mars. Because what we got going on is I told you guys about me moving, and I've moved to Arizona now. So now I'm a resident of Arizona, and that was a lot of work, and that's why I wasn't here for the last 2 weeks. Actually, a week ago I was moving. The week before that was the MUFON Symposium, which, of course, I was a big part of because I was the Director of Public Education and Media Relations for MUFON International. You might have heard the was part, and if you saw my homepage, or at least my Facebook, you'll see I changed that a little bit, because now I am actually a radio host and investigator, and actually we don't have my title complete, for openminds.tv. So check this out. This is where you're going to go to see information on the radio show, and where you're going to go to hear the radio show. UFO thinks it's going to be there, but it's going to mostly point you to openminds.tv. Which is the new organization that I am part of. And this is sweet because this is a UFO magazine, TV, and radio, and online. We're an overall UFO media group, and it's not like small potatoes. We've got, you know, John Rayo, this guy owns multiple companies. He's the one who started this up. He's hired some of the best, and so when you go to the website right now, open.tv, you're going to see this thing is sweet. This thing's cutting edge. It looks cool as heck. We got this creepy, sticky-looking, ugly little monster thing on our front page right now, because that's something that was found in Mexico. We're partnered up with Jaime Musan, the famous, and he is famous in Mexico, famous researcher, and he, you know, so they found this little creature down there that they, some of them believe is an alien, but we're going to do some DNA work and find out what this thing might really be. But, yeah, so you've got that there, and you can see that on the website. But for my radio show, we're going to be able to buy new equipment, so I know people have complained, and, you know, I complain that the audio for the guests is sometimes pretty bad. Sometimes you can't really hear them very well, and I have absolutely no control over the audio. Well, being a one-man band and just limited to that they provide me, I haven't been able to do much about it, unfortunately. And even so, I'm the number one paranormal show and number one UFO podcast, but we've got equipment on the way, literally ordered, that's going to be able to channel all of this through a mixing board. So we're going to be able to fix those audio levels, come across better. We're getting cool speakers that we're going to have going, our microphones, professional microphones I'll be able to use. Not only that, we're going to have the use the video option. So you might see when you're in the chat here, you probably notice there's a little video screen you can activate. Well, we're going to use that where you'll be able to activate that and you'll be able to watch me talking. And sometimes we'll have people in the studio that you'll be able to watch as well. Even cooler than that, we're going to take that and we're going to have a second video podcast. So we'll make that available. So maybe video podcasts, you prefer, you'll be able to get it either way, audio or audio with video. Some just to see me, you know, sitting here working the gear and stuff. But sometimes we'll have the guests in the studio, so that'll be a lot of fun. And you'll be able to see that portion. And maybe I'll, you know, get some guest person to come on for part of the show, maybe do some special update, something. But anyway, you're going to be able to see that. So that's extremely cool. Not only that, we've got future for other video podcasts that we're going to do. Also, Open Minds TV has a magazine underway. Maurizio Baiada, you've heard me talking about him. Maurizio Baiada, he is the editor-in-chief for Area 51 magazine, which was in Italy. That magazine's no longer around, and it looks great. It looks incredible. I don't know. I don't read Italian, a couple of them, so I haven't been able to read them, but I'm sure, you know, I've had Paula Harris on, talked about her. She's a good friend of mine. She was a writer for that magazine, so I'm sure the content was fabulous, but he is doing the magazine, and that's literally underway right now. I've got to see, you know, the images. Our graphic designers are incredible. They come up with the coolest stuff. You'll have to go see what our logo looks like. It's just extremely cool. So let's see. That's what we're doing. We're also coming up with a TV show. So we'll be doing TV shows and documentaries. That's something I'm helping out right now, doing some research for the TV show. So I'm literally a full-time ufologist for Open Minds TV. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a dream come true. So very cool stuff is going to be going on. Because of that, because now I'm paid full-time, you know, to do this stuff, I'm moving the radio show to a time so I can do it in the office, so I can utilize all that cool equipment with my buddies I work with there. So I'm moving the show to 4 p.m. Pacific on Thursdays. So Thursday, 4 p.m. Pacific. And right now, I think because we're here in Arizona, which makes it kind of weird because, you know, the time zones don't change. So when the time, when we come up across the next time change, then we'll switch to Central. But for, so it's 4 o'clock. That way the East Coasters, for example, right now we've got an East Coaster as a guest, and it's 7 o'clock here, but 10 o'clock there, so it's pretty late. So for you East Coasters, it'll be 7 o'clock. You know, for the Central, for the Pacific, it'll be more during you know, rush hour time when you're coming home. Or, you know, if you can join us live, that would be awesome. You're going to want to, you know, at the end of the day on a Thursday, just bring us up right there at work on your work computer. You know, tell them, dudes, I'm chilling out. I'm getting the info on the UFOs because it could mean all of our lives could be at stake here. Tell them that I'm listening. I'm in on what's going on here, because what if a UFO flies over work and is sucking people out of their seats? I'm going to be able to know that so I can alert everybody here at work. And so it's a safety concern. Let them know that. That's why you're listening in on the show. So that's what we're going to be doing. So some really cool, awesome stuff. In fact, you know, I'll be changing the name of the radio show over to Open Minds as opposed to UFO Think Tank. But like I said, I'll have the website open. And what I'm getting into next is the UFO news as usual. We're going to have the UFO news on the front page of our Open Minds TV website. So I'll be administering that. And as soon as next week, you'll see the radio here too. So really cool ideas for that. They've got some really neat ideas for a custom radio player that they're going to put on the front page of the website. So very excited, very cool, awesome stuff. This is going to be great, people. This is going to be good. Also, I want to say I see Jackal in the chat room. I want to say to me on his radio show. He's been doing a Blog Talk radio show called In Jackal's Head. So you can check that out on Blog Talk Radio. And if you want to say hi, Jackal's in the chat there. Cool dude. We had a lot of fun. Jesse Randall, or I don't know. Jesse has these AKA last names he likes to go by. But Jesse from UFO Not Radio was also there with us. So that was a lot of fun talking about some stuff. But let's go ahead. That's the updates, people. Exciting stuff. Excited about it. I hope you are. Trust me, there's going to be some cool stuff coming up. But let's get into the UFO news. It's been a couple of weeks, so I'm not going to go back that far, but I'll go back at least to what's furthest back listed on my page here. Remember, you can go read these news at ufothinktank.com and keep going there for now, and it'll point to Open Minds. But you may have seen there was a video out there of a UFO capturing an airplane, and that got people excited for a little bit there. And you see this video of this, you know, dot up there in the sky. Even had it in HD where it kind of, this dot is moving in strange ways and kind of merges with this plane and then shoots up in the sky, and the plane and the object are both gone. Well, Roger Marr, UFO Examiner, had gotten a hold of me and told me he was able to show that, and he got a hold of the guy. It was a proven hoax, and the guy who did it was doing it for his kind of CGI profile. You know, so he's a CGI specialist or a student, and so he was just practicing. It would be nice, though, if these guys would say that. I know they're all excited about their skills and everything and how real they're able to get stuff to look, but they always post these things as if they're real on the Internet. And this guy was even, you know, conversing back and forth with people about how it's real, and that's very unfortunate that he would lie to people. Not just, you thought it was real, but, you know, it's really just me, and isn't my work great? And people would be like, hey, great work, it does look real. But, you know, jerk. Anyway, also, Brazil has released 1,300 more pages from their secret UFO documents. And so hopefully there's some good stuff in there. I haven't heard much about that. Hopefully we'll be able to talk to someone about what's in there, or at least get a glimpse of what might be in there, because I haven't heard of anything good coming up that got some great stories. Not like the Britain UFO stories, because Britain has released yet again another batch of UFO files, and it's been a while. It's been a few months this time. They were releasing them, you know, a batch a month for a little bit there, and this is a three-year process for them to release all their files in small batches, you know, periodically. And in this last batch, sure enough, you know, they hit the news again, which is great. And that news has finally gotten over here to the U.S. USA Today and Reuters had just reported on this late last week, even though Britain released their files early last week. And then if you go on Google and research this, you'll see that British newspapers have gone crazy. They're posting all kinds of stuff about this, British and Irish newspapers. And the reason being, because they're reporting, you know, Britain, MOD, released a bunch of files, and in our city there were three sightings. So local papers are talking about where they're mentioned in these files. Those local papers are excited about talking about what sightings were in those files that happened in their areas. Just releasing the files is what has hit United States news. However, one of the big stories from these British files, which I'm excited about, his lord, and he was actually an admiral, Hill Norton. And there's a video, I believe even on the Disclosure Project, they have him talking about UFOs. But it talks about how this gentleman, who for a period of time was the head of the armed forces in Britain, was talking about when Randlesham Forest happened, he was upset because he felt that they needed to cover it more seriously. So that was a great story that made, you know, bigger news out there in the UK and hopefully makes it over here, because, of course, this was a big, important person telling people, you know, you guys need to take these stories more seriously. And if you're not familiar with Randlesham Forest, this was a case that happened over in the U.S. in England, and some of their soldiers saw some lights in Randlesham Forest next to the base, so they went out to investigate, including a Colonel Holt, who many of these witnesses have been on Larry King before, at least, well, a couple of them, and they saw these lights, you know, flying through the forest. When they got close to one of them, it shot up and took off. Well, Colonel Holt himself went out to look for these things. He saw the lights, and he saw the lights shooting up into the sky. So he saw this whole thing with his own eyes, and in fact, they've released an audio recording of them creeping up on this thing. You know, one of them, they said, looked like a large, about 8-foot-tall pyramid-shaped object that was lit up like a Christmas tree that was moving around in the forest. So they saw some really interesting things. Now, miles off was a lighthouse, or is a lighthouse, and of course the debunkers say they were mistaking this lighthouse for, you know, this object, and some of them have also said there were police in the area that they were mistaking this for, but which is pretty ridiculous. You know, these soldiers know the difference between a lighthouse light that they're seeing off in the distance, or even a police car driving around in the forest, than lights that are going in and out. In fact, one of the guys who went out to look, he went out and he recorded this incident. He found a elongated pyramid type thing, but it was on its side, just floating there in the forest. And he actually went up there and touched it and recorded his, took notes on it, and before this thing shot up in the sky and took off. So really great case. You know, when Nick Pope was on, we talked about that. It's often referred to as England's Roswell, and it probably is a better case than Roswell because we have witnesses who are all talking about it. And it was cool because when these guys were on Larry King, you know, a few months ago, I think it was almost a year ago now, Larry King was blown away. He took these guys very seriously, and how can you not? These guys knew what they were doing. They're very cool, and you can tell they're very intelligent people, and they were mystified, and they don't go to say, as far as to say, or even speculate what it is they might have seen. Actually, up until recently, they weren't speculating as to what it was that they had seen. They just didn't know. These things were strange. They weren't ours. They were technology beyond ours. But actually, Colonel Holt recently has said that he does believe that they're extraterrestrial. He wasn't saying that prior to this. So pretty interesting. Larry King also had another special on recently. It was all right. You know, he had Nick Pope. You can go on YouTube and find this, or I've got the YouTube posted here on my website also. But he had Seth Shostak, you know, the debunker from SETI, on again, which is always frustrating. He had Nick Pope and James Fox, and he always has James Fox on. James Fox, the great documentary, Out of the Blue. He's working on another documentary. But, yeah, I don't know. I didn't find that there was much added on this Larry King. You know, Seth Shostak and James Fox, he has on all the time. So it would have been nice if he would have had some other people on the show this time. Other stories I have on here, James Carrion, the MUFON International Director, has a blog that he's been starting up. He makes it very clear his personal opinions, not the official opinion of MUFON. So, but he's been wanting to, you know, get some of his research and what he's finding out there. And speaking of the UFO examiner, Roger Marsh, he pulled some stories from the CMS, the MUFON case management system. So he's got some great stories up here, too. Reports of multiple UFOs over the skies in Ohio and August 15th. A former Navy SEAL who watched orange lights converge on a V-shaped UFO. We also have Pennsylvania orb UFO that was videotaped over a local farm, and they're seeing a lot of these orbs in Pennsylvania. You might remember that fairly recently we had John Venture, the state director for Pennsylvania, on, and he talked a lot about these orbs that they're seeing out there. Three Oregon witnesses reported multiple UFOs on August 12th. A UFO, again, in Pennsylvania hovered over a barn as witnesses watched from their car. Florida witnesses claimed to have real UFO videos. A triangle was seen in Crosby, Texas. Orange blob UFO dropped low over Jessup, Pennsylvania. It's incredible. Someone's got to, you know, go out there and hopefully get something, because these orange blobs over Pennsylvania, what's going on? Another triangle UFO with a bubble nose reported actually in Walsenburg, Colorado. And I drove right next to Walsenburg when I came out here. This was the 21st, so I was already out here by then, so missed it. And then six Kansas witnesses shot low flying black triangle. So the black triangles are back, people. They've never gone anywhere. And of course, it's highly debated, are those black triangles ours or theirs? Whose are they? So very interesting stuff. Well, let's go ahead and bring on our guest. And I'm going to have to dial him up because I figured that the sound is a little better when we dial them up as opposed to when we just have them call in. But we'll have this whole sound thing fixed very soon, and I'm so excited about that because we will have professional equipment, and I will have someone to do the dialing for me. I mean, this is beautiful. He'll be able to screen calls just in case, you know, our resident heckler Pastor Pat calls in and is trying to be a jerky. By the way, we're going to talk to Scott about the Aztec crash, and the supposed base in Dulce. Oh, some music. There were birds in the sky.
Hello.
Hello, is this Suzanne?
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Alejandro Rojas with UFO Think Tank Radio.
Hi, Alejandro, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, are we on the air?
You are on the air.
Wow. Well, it's nice to hear from you folks.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to hear from you, too. So let's go ahead and get started.
Okay. Excuse me. Just one second.
Okay.
Scott, and we'll be ready to roll.
All right.
Honey, while I'm here. Oh. I'm sorry. Okay.
Here he comes.
All righty. What can I do for you? How can I help you?
All right. Well, let's start off with Aztec. What got you all interested in researching that alleged UFO crash?
Okay. Really two different reasons for two different people. Scott started years before I did, although I lived in the area. I was interested in it, and oddly enough, my mother and father had lived in the Midwest, and my mom was interested when they were deciding to move in the Southwest and to a little climate. they decided to look into Aztec because she was always intrigued by the crash. And she got there and really there wasn't a whole lot going on. People weren't really interested in it. But she had read Frank Scully's book many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a little girl. And that was kind of the end of it for a while. And I got re-interested in it when Scott came into my life. And Scott actually was doing some business out there just by chance. We've often said how our lives changed because of it, but he was in town doing some business and checking on a potential customer and ended up being a very good customer of his. But while he was there, he spoke to a couple fellows that worked at this plant that he was visiting, and they were talking about doing some hunting, deer hunting, out by the old site. And he, being new in town, asked, well, what are you referring to about the old crash site? And they began to tell him, you know, a little bit about that there was supposedly a UFO that had crashed there in 1948. And this customer began to be a very good customer of Scott, so he was about there out in that area about every 6 to 8 weeks. And so every time he would start to do research on it, he figured, well, I'll probably have this all wrapped up in about 6 months. And this is 20 plus years later, and boy, there's always new information coming out. So that was a surprise that I don't think he expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. You meet someone and they remind you of a UFO crash. That's really cool. You guys had a similar interest. Now, the Frank Scully book, and for people who don't know, it's called Behind the Flying Saucers, and actually Scully from the X-Files is named after Frank Scully.
Great.
Now, what did you think of that? Did you put, because at least in the field, you know, people had really done a job on him in the book and said he was conned by two oil men. So did you put much faith into it? Were you skeptical?
Well, let me step back, and I'm going to, we'll touch on that in a second if we can, but let me give you a little background.
Mm-hmm.
Scott actually had done research. He had read Wendell Stevens' book and Frank Scully's book and started looking at some of the work had been done already and just seeing, because there really was not a whole lot of information available in Aztec, New Mexico itself.
Mm-hmm.
But he started looking into the people that were probably witnesses, and what he has done is dissected, I guess I'll use that term, Frank Scully's book, every single ounce of it,
mm-hmm.
and see if it is credible, and to see if it's accurate. And it is amazing how accurate it is. And in reference to the two oil men, and I'll just touch on this, but Scott will be able to elaborate on it more. There's a lot of speculation about that they duped him, but that's what Scott was interested in proving or disproving. You know, he is a true researcher, and a little background, and this will give you why the valleys and peaks that he will go to find out and document something, not just go on someone's opinion or light information or, you know, research through the internet. He, as a little boy, my husband Scott, as a little boy, would go to the Outer Banks with his family every year for vacation,
mm-hmm.
a couple weeks out there. And since he was a small, small boy, if you've ever been to the Outer Banks, it's one of the areas along the coast of North Carolina that ships would come in and would be sunk.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds and hundreds still there lined up. And Scott's father required, as things would wash up, of course it was a lot more then when he was a boy than now, but when there would be a storm, there would be all types of articles that would wash up on the shore, everything from hatch covers to all types of things from ships. And Scott's dad would make the boys pick him up off the beach and then would make them over their vacation go down to the newspaper office, go down to the different records and things and document and find out where these pieces and articles were, what ships, what make, what year.
Wow, cool.
All of those things. Yeah. So he had, you know, from a very, very small boy, had on some great experience in doing proper research and finding niches and holes where someone else might not see them. So he had that instilled in him. And so looking at Frank Scully's book, he, through the records, we have over 7,000 documents that refer to things that Scott has documented Frank Scully's research on. So I know it's kind of a roundabout way for me to explain, but I think it's not just a simple question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Scully did some, I don't really know that he even had to do research. I think he had just some really good information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what the book seems like. Mostly witnesses or insiders who gave him some great information, and it's interesting. I guess just like now, things are so easily debunked and people blow them off. But, you know, reading the book, it's so detailed. And even to this day around the, make propulsion and stuff like that, it sounds very feasible.
Well, and that's some of the stuff that Scott has gone to document and to find out who Dr. G was and and find out more information about Silas Newton and Leo Gepauer. The facts are that the skeptics oftentimes say that they were nothing but con men, but I think that they weigh that so heavy. Now that's going to sound like a goofy statement, but I think there's a lot of emphasis put on, they were con men. But that's an easy statement to cast against someone's name without documenting it. What Scott has found in his research is that these gentlemen were philanthropists. They donated and gave all types of money. They were heavily involved in their communities. They were, really pillars. And the FBI documents say that they were pillars of the community. Mm. Now, after this incident happened, they were not so highly regarded. And after they shared this information, there's also a court case that's often found where they talk about people feeling like they were jilted and money taken from them on some false oil speculations. But that's one of the things that Scott has really dug into too, is the research that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that it says that they, what's the term that they use, Fon, honey, that they say that they were
confidential.
They were con artists, but
right.
They claim, but they about the fact that they were actually thrown in jail and all of these things and a lot of these things, and this is what's so disappointing with skeptics for me, is that it's slandering someone's name or just throwing around information, but they don't have to go through and prove it.
It sounds like a smear campaign, essentially.
It really, I think that mm-hmm. really is a good statement. But and that personally is something that I have trouble with the skeptics. I have seen with my husband Scott, as well as some of the other really devoted researchers in this field, that they really open their arms to skeptics that are really credible, skeptics that will go in and do really good research and challenge mm-hmm. them because it raises the bar.
Right.
And but unfortunately, there aren't many people like that out there. It seems to be people that say a lot of things, but they don't ever even research or never been to the location or never
mm-hmm.
really done anything. They just speculate, and that's disappointing because I don't think that's good for them.
Right. I agree. Yeah, it almost seems... I just don't see why these, successful rich oil men would want to spend all this time, and it would have to have been very difficult to con this guy, to come up with these elaborate stories and places. They would have had to done so much research and spent so much time putting their story together before they even going out and doing that talk at the University of Denver. I mean, they would have had to have done that all as this scheme to con Frank Scully. Doesn't seem like
a person would waste much time doing that, does it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they would have better things to do. But
yeah.
And like I say, that's one of the things Scott's working on a book right now, and that's one of the things that is so exciting 20-some years into this research and you know, lots and lots of years since 1948, you know, is that we still are unfolding and unveiling things that Frank writes about in the book and documenting them. And it's hard to believe that that's even possible, but it is. But Frank was a very good writer. I've written for a living, and I for part of my living, and I really respect, and it's amazing how exact and explicit that he is. Of course, he expected that this information within a year was going to be given out to the public, and that's when some problems started to begin. But
well, how confident are you then that this event did happen?
Well, and I can only speak for myself. Scott would be able to address that too, but I feel as though the information that Frank Scully has written is accurate, and that this did happen, and simply because every single thing that he's written in there, Scott has documented the ability to move the craft, and he's tracked down witnesses, and comes about things with objective view. You know, you don't go into records, you don't go in to do research with an opinion, because if you do, you're gonna tilt it, and that includes interviewing the witnesses. You can't lead a witness. You can't ask them questions that feed them information.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen that happen, and I'm very comfortable with the fact that this happened. And again, Scott would be able to address that personally for him, but I think that there's a lot of documentation and a lot of proof, and I think that this is a very important part of history that has been overlooked. Now, like I said, Bill Steinman and Wendell Stevens, and then of course Frank Scully, those are three people that have done, you know, a lot of work. Frank with reporting it, and Wendell and Bill with actually researching it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very
mm-hmm. Now, there one of the more controversial or amazing claims that, you know, is in the Scully book was that there were 16 bodies found on this vehicle.
Right.
Do you feel that part is accurate as well?
You know, most of our research has been about documenting that this incident actually happened. And Scott has spoken to a witness that actually looked in and saw two of the bodies. And they were slumped over, and they were using a pole and poked in, and they were able to look in the craft. And so, from that standpoint, yes, I can't say myself 16. I don't really know, but I can say that one of the witnesses that we personally interviewed clearly saw two of the bodies slumped over.
Mm-hmm. And then, from the research that you've done, how, I guess, do you feel that you all have amassed enough evidence to prove that this happened?
Well, you know, the missing link is a smoking gun. You know, there is no craft. We don't have the craft. And honestly, probably never will.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very unlikely. But boy, if you can provide us with that, we'd be happy to get on that. But I feel like there is enough. My personal opinion, again, this is my personal opinion, is that if you took this to a court of law, it would stand up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that speaks for itself, that there is enough evidence to prove it.
Have you been able to change some people's minds with what showing them what you have?
Yes, and you know what's really exciting, I think, is people that, well, when I discuss with people about the fact that the research that we do, oftentimes, as I'm sure that you're familiar, when someone hears UFO, usually get several different reactions.
Mm-hmm.
If they personally had an experience, they light up. If they haven't, they either shut down or you see their eyes kind of glaze over like, oh boy, what's this, right? Don't you?
Yeah, you're exactly right.
And one of the things that I have found is because of the dedication that Scott's had for the, you know, 20-some years in doing this, that layer by layer by layer, you know, traveling all over the country, doing what needs to be done, I look at this as an important, what's the word I want to use, an important portion of history and that be documented. And so, to me, I feel like, you know, getting this all this information down and in an understandable way is very, very important. And so when I discuss with people, someone new that I'm meeting, you know, that my husband does, and my husband and I do historical research, and that's the way that we refer to it,
mm-hmm.
and then sit down and explain to them that this is about a UFO crash or a supposed UFO crash or landing that happened in Aztec, New Mexico, and explain to them what that really means. And like I said, that we have 7,000 documents refer to it, that our FBI, CIA, and military reports, you know, when we start to go about it that way and explain it from that position, it's amazing how many people go, wow, that's really interesting, and they don't shut down. As well as, I think that we've run into people that really thought had kind of written Aztec off because of information that the skeptics had done. Could you get me a glass of water? Because of the information that the skeptics had passed around, and it was false information and
mm-hmm.
misguided information. And to really sit down and start to show them the documents and show them the flow chart, it's amazing how many people say, wow, and they're very comfortable with it. They feel confident with it,
mm-hmm.
too.
Yeah, that's one frustrating aspect, that as a UFO researcher, your information has to be spot on, whereas
right.
the debunkers, they have to spend very little effort, or they could just make something up. And, you know, unfortunately, in people's minds, what they have to say weighs heavier than what a researcher has to say. So you really, you know, that's what gets tough in when someone just loosely looks at this field. You have to really get into the details to figure out, you know, what's real and what's not.
And, you know, I think that most people are intelligent
mm-hmm.
enough that when you start to give information and you lay something like this out, you know, we really have never tried to persuade anyone. Really,
mm-hmm.
that's of no interest. It's to document something or to document that it didn't happen. And that would be fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, like I said, important to know one way or the other. And I think that, you know, it's like I said, an important part of history.
Yeah. So which, what evidence seems to be the most convincing to people?
Depending on where we're at and who we're talking to. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, if we're someplace where we can sit down and we can really share documents and things, then that has a tremendous amount of pull, because that's not something that we made up. That's not just someone's opinion. Those are documents from the government that are, you know, that talk about it. And
mm-hmm.
so that has a lot of weight, as you can imagine. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not theory, it's not hearsay then. So that always is helpful. But if sitting and visiting with someone, you know, if we're at dinner or something, just walking through the process and talking about, you know, what actually happened at the incident and the impact that it had on the witnesses' lives and and kind of going through the who Dr. G is and the impact of the scientists that were Dr. G on the world today, and you know, going through and actually showing that there has been some real thought and documentation, I think people like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to have a radio show years ago. One of the things that is very, very important to me is that you don't spoon feed anyone. And I actually told my husband that the other night. I said, you know, one of the things that attracted me the most and that I respect, because it's a very important factor for me, is that you don't try and tell people what they should think, because I really believe people are intelligent enough. If you give them factual information, they may agree, they may disagree, but they can come to their own conclusion. They don't need to be spoon-fed information.
Yeah. What are some of the government documents that you've come across that you were, you know, like, all right, or some really convincing documents that you've come across?
Well, I'm going to hand the phone to Scott because he'll be able to help you with that, but I will just
okay.
say there were some things that have happened with people that said that they had pictures of craft, and Scott can address that. There are just really, really interesting things, and I'm sure you'll only be able to touch on a few of them.
Hey, before you hand the phone over to him, I have a couple more questions for you.
Okay, let me jot this down so Scott knows to come back to this. And
okay.
On the historical. Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you your outings to the area, which I'm sure you've done plenty of them. What have they been like? Have you had any interesting experiences out there in the deserts of New Mexico?
Again, Scott's going to be able to address that better than I. He's spent a whole lot of time. Now, I lived in the area.
Mm-hmm.
But for years. But in terms of the crash site itself, you know, he may be able to tell you some interesting things. I will tell you that just this last year we received aerial views of the crash site, and oh my gosh, it was the most exciting thing because it only further documents all the time that he spent on the ground. Mm-hmm. Digging and cutting into the cement slab and all the things that he poured his heart and soul out. I mean, I could say thousands and thousands and thousands of hours on that ground. And then we were able to get an aerial view. And my gosh, Alejandro, it is so exciting to see the impact that it actually had from the air. I mean, on that property,
mm-hmm.
the trees. And the trees that were pushed down then, you can see here in the middle of the desert, you can see rows of trees that were planted to cover it.
Wow.
Now, isn't that it? Now, I don't know if you've ever been to New Mexico, have you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then for those folks that have not been to that area, it's high desert. So it never gets usually over 100 degrees and might get snow once in a while. But you can see the snow-capped mountains of Colorado from there. It's simply gorgeous. And it's real, real rugged. The roads are real, real rugged out there. And the terrain is very, very rugged. You wouldn't want to take a sports car or something out there. And it's quite a hike to get to where you need to go. And there's no way nature grows in rows. It doesn't. You know, nature grows in scattered. And so that is one of the things that I will say out at the crash site that is just blows your mind. There's a road, of course, that if anyone's familiar with the story, there is a road that up until just recently was never put on a map. It has no reason to be there. They call it the mystery road. But from the gathering that we've gotten and from a particular witness of Scott's, that's what they put in so they could get to it. It goes nowhere.
Wow.
There is the cement slab there. And one of the witnesses that was an officer that would locate things that they needed to get to the craft site and to take care of them while they're there, he... told Scott, when you find a cement slab, you'll know you're there. Well, they had to dig. They had to go understand, and, you know, this is years and years ago, and they found a cement slab that's out there. I can tell you this. Skeptics say that it's an oil well cap, because there's a lot of oil wells out there. Well, they dug into it, and to get some of it to test to see if they could further document that it was from 1948, and, you know, to get some information. And it would have blown sky high if they would have drilled into it to get a core sample, and if it had been a well cap. And so, you know, there's no way. And it is out there. And when you talk to people, either ranchers or oil field people, which are the two dominant occupations out in that particular area, you see absolutely no reason for it to be there. And they've never seen anything like it before. It's just a plain, simple slab, but there's no reason for that cement to be out there. And what the sir had told Scott that he interviewed was that this slab was used because the ground out there is very silty. And so putting a crane to lift the craft, keep in mind that it was 100 feet across, 99.9 feet across, that in order to lift it, even though it was light, it's very awkward. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, they had to take a crane out there. Well, I'm sure you're familiar that a crane just doesn't work in silty ground. It needs something solid to be on to lift. And so that's another interesting thing that's out there. It's a beautiful place. If you have no interest in UFOs, it's wonderful just to go there just to enjoy the beauty.
That area is really pretty. And what do the locals think about what you guys are doing or about the whole legend of the crash?
Very mixed feelings. I think you get a little of everything. Everything from it didn't happen, clearly, oh, it didn't happen, or we would have known it, to you know, people that say that, oh, you know, we've had family members that saw it or were involved with it, or we saw, you know, some of the ramifications from it, or we've always had an interest, or, you know, my family worked for the sheriff's department, and we've been told all along that this happened, or, you know, I mean, very, very mixed. I think a lot of people just shut down and want nothing to think or do about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's out of their comfort zone, and they're just not interested at all, and, you know, that's fine.
Yeah. All right, well then, thank you very much for all the information, and I guess if we'll bring Scott on and ask him about some of those details then.
Sure. If I can help, just I'll come back on when you need me, okay?
Okay, great, thank you.
What he needs to know is about the documents that were most interesting, okay? He's going to pick up the other phone, okay?
Okay, you too.
Good evening.
Hello there, how are you?
Good, how are you tonight?
Not too bad.
Sorry, I was a little late on the queue here.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Nope, we got it all rolling, so no problem. So I guess maybe let's start off, though, with how you got interested in investigating this whole thing.
Well, like Suzanne was telling, I heard about it back in the late 80s while out in Farmington on a business trip. Seeing at that time, a potential customer, and talking to some of the guys. It's a facility that rewinds big generators, big electric motors, and just laying low one night, we were testing a generator, and some of the guys in the shop were talking about going muleting, and I was just kind of eavesdropping on the conversation. They mentioned out by the old crash site on Hart Canyon Road. And I kind of was trying to butt myself into the conversation. I said, well, what site? And they kind of shrugged it off and said, you know, old wives' tale about a UFO that crashed out there late 40s, early 50s. So later that night, we went back to the Holiday Inn there in Farmington to relax and have a beer. And I wanted to hear more of this story. And they drew me a map on a napkin and said, it's really rough terrain, but and we don't know if there's anything to the story or not, but be careful, and, you know, here's how you get out there. And I didn't find it that trip. It took me another trip or two before I found what later I in comparing Bill Steinman's book, it was years later before I got a copy of that. But I think we both confirmed, and I talked to Bill on a relatively recent basis, so to speak, but we concur that we're both talking about the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about 11.5-12 miles northeast of the town of Aztec.
Okay, and then at what point then did you actually go to Scully's book and read it?
I got Scully's book. People were sending me Xerox copies of different parts of it.
Mm.
I didn't get a copy of Scully's book. The Aztec Public Library actually gave me one as a gift.
Oh, cool.
When they started their, I'm trying to think what year it was. I think it was 2001. I was helping them with their symposium every year. And Leanne Hathcock and some of the members of the Friends of the Library presented me with a very nice copy of Frank Scully's book, which, as a matter of fact, I have sitting right here in front of me.
Great.
And so I had done my own research up until then. At least I was 10 years into it, and I had read excerpts of it that people would send me. Then it was interesting to sit down and take what Frank wrote, and then later Bill Steinman wrote, and compare it to what I had researched, and compare it even today to what I've done, other people have done, Suzanne and I have done together. And as she was saying, I kind of walked in as she was telling you that part, it's amazing how accurate both Scully's book is as far as the baseline of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And what a really good job that Bill Steinman and Wendell Stevens have done in their book, which I think they got very little credit for back when the book came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, luckily, I had gotten a copy of the book that was just trashed. You know, I got it online, and it can be hard to find, so it was just in awful condition. And then when I got out here to Arizona with Open Minds, we bought Wendell Stevens' record, so I get to spend a lot of time with him, actually, and see him on Monday again. And he has a good copy of it. So
yeah.
I was looking through it, coincidentally enough, because, you know, you probably are aware, Scully mentioned four crashes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is right here in Phoenix.
Paradise Valley.
Yeah, the Paradise Valley. So I've been researching that one. And I've found there's been very little research on that one.
Interesting.
Yeah, so have you looked into that one at all?
Not very much.
Okay,
no,
let me know.
I'm kind of focused. Mm-hmm. My whole historic research has really been just on Aztec.
Mm-hmm. And
I find all the stories interesting. Don't get me wrong. I find them all fascinating,
right,
and I think they're all tied in. But you've got, you know, people like Stan Friedman and Dennis Balthaser and Tom Carey and that group that have, and Kevin Randall too, and not to leave him out, a lot of people that have really spent a lot of time on Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all done a very good job on it. Aztec really never got much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what kind of drew me to it. Why didn't it? Well, you know, what chased everybody away from Aztec?
Yeah.
And of course there was the obvious. There was the allegations that Silas Newton and Leo Getower were con men, and the J.P. Kahn issue, where J.P. Kahn stepped in as a jealous writer that had tried to buy the story from Frank Scully, and the whole thing got so muddied up that I think for years nobody in the field of UFO research wanted to touch Aztec with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm. So, and mentioning that too, you know, and I know Suzanne had touched on it for the listeners, that the two, according to the book, there were two witnesses or two sources of information, one of those being Dr. G. the rule of thumb, or at least with the debunking out there, is that Dr. G was one person who was one of these con men oilmen. However, according to Frank Scully, and it sounds like you've found this in your research as well, that Dr. G was a compilation of many different people.
Yes, he was a composition of eight scientists.
Eight different scientists, really? Wow. And what sort of work did these scientists do?
Oh, now you're going to give up our book that we're writing.
Oh, well, you don't got to give me their names or their phone numbers.
Name, rank, and serial number.
Well, when is your book going to be?
We don't have a time frame on it. Every time we put a date on the completion, it turns around and bites us. So we're just going with the flow right now.
Well, I'm going to need you to get this done in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Maybe just some generalizations.
I think that Scully hits the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm.
The way he introduces them in the book, they were men of science. If you look at what Frank Scully wrote about Dr. G, they obviously were with OSRD during World War II. They talk about sinking submarines, knocking missiles out of the sky. And for all your listeners, just look at who was with OSRD back in World War II. OSRD, if you follow the chain of command, Dr. Vannevar Bush that headed up OSRD, and that was Manhattan Project and everything underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Office of Scientific Research and Development.
So
And Scully, I think, was very accurate in the fact that these would have been the men of science that had, by 1948 or even 47 for that matter, if an object was to be recovered and analyzed by the best of the best, this would have been the group of people you would have had looking at.
Mm-hmm. And it seems as though from, looking back in those days, that, and we're talking early 50s, there wasn't as much secrecy, or at least the people didn't feel like, a lot of people seem to be, if you read like Donald Kehoe's books and things like that, a lot of people seem to be under the impression that this information from these crashes and everything was being prepared for the public, and they thought that the public was going to be let in on all of this very soon, so it wasn't a big deal to be secretive.
That's true. Coming off the victory of World War II, and as the public was starting, and I emphasize starting, to learn all the secrets and all the tens of thousands of people that worked in secret projects to win World War II, I think the American public was thinking, well, as we're learning this, there's certainly a chance for us to learn that.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. G at one point alludes to in Scully's book that this secret would be broken in a short time, and I forget how he worded it. But then later in the book, and the book we're talking about for your audience is The Flying Saucers, written by Frank Scully. It was released in the fall of 1950 by Henry Hoyt and Company. Later in the book, Scully alludes to the fact that Dr. G knew damn well this story would never break.
Mm.
It was, for whatever personal reason, Dr. G wanted Scully to break this to the public.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I remember correctly, when we talked before, or when I've seen you talk, you were a little skeptical about this whole thing when you started researching.
Oh, about Aztec?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely I was.
Yeah. What was it that...
I make no bones about that.
Assuming you have changed your mind, what was it that did change your mind?
A lot of things. Somebody at the other night, and Suzanne and I have talked about this many, many, many hours. I think as I first looked into Aztec, the town was pretty much divided into pie pieces of nothing happened out there, it's all a big joke, to nothing happened out there, but we don't think it was a flying saucer. And then it took years to get to the people that said, yes, something happened out there and you need to talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Once I started seeing, and Aztec then, as it is today, I have to do a little commercial for Aztec here. From our home in Mooresville, North Carolina, so it's not like Suzanne and I live there, but we'd love to. Aztec is a beautiful, quaint little town. And I think I heard Suzanne mention earlier, even if you're not into the flying saucer stories of the 50s or whatever, it's still a beautiful place. You got to put it on your map of places to go just to visit. And as I was starting to research, I found that there's a lot of very credible and old families in that area.
Mm-hmm.
There were families that homesteaded or settled in the 1860s. So a lot of that old blood is still there. And when you get some of those people saying something happened, it makes you stop and look.
Mm-hmm.
That was the initial stages. Those are the ones that kind of put the hook in my mouth. The second part was, as I was reading more and more about what people were saying negative about it as to why it couldn't happen, their stories weren't holding up. And so all of a sudden, the skeptics were starting to fall toward the bottom of the pile, and the fact of a UFO recovery started to raise to the top.
Yeah, which is interesting. Suzanne and I were talking about that a bit, how the debunkers can make just blatant statements that are not true or speculation, and a lot of people, you know, take that to heart and are convinced, whereas for the researchers, we really got to prove something. So with this field, you can't just take the debunker's word. You got to really look at the details, and you'll find interesting things like you have.
Well, you know, Frank Warren's the UFO Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
He and I laugh. We talk quite a bit, and we always laugh that if somebody who's doing credible research in the field of UFO studies doesn't cross a T or dot an I, they're hung out to dry.
Right.
God forbid they misspell a name,
and then you
have debunkers, and all of the debunkers. I'm not going to leave any of them out unless somebody can point one that I've missed. All of the debunkers that were debunking Aztec, none of them had been to Aztec.
Right.
The late Carl Flock, who I got along with very well. We agreed about 99% about things in life, from politics to gun control to whatever. Or actually, when it came to Carl and I, no gun control, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to Aztec, we were split. But we had Carl come up and speak as a guest speaker at the Aztec Symposium, and I think it was 2002. Maybe it was 2001. And Carl only lived about 2.5 hours from Aztec. He lived north of Albuquerque. And I took Carl out to the crash site, and I was just in shock that he had never been there. I said, Carl, I'm 1,870 miles away, and I'm out here all the time. How can you write negative things about Aztec when you haven't even been out to the crash site and looked around? And I compared it to a homicide detective trying to solve a murder case from his desk.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there were others. There was Dave Thomas from Albuquerque. You know, he wrote a lot of negative things on Aztec. And until he came up as a guest speaker twice, 2 years, he had never been to the crash site.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm I'm not even sure to this day he has, because when we went out as a group, I don't recall him joining us. I don't know how you can write negative things and debunk things. I don't mind, like I heard Suzanne talking. We enjoy skeptics. Skeptics are healthy.
Right.
I started out skeptical on Aztec, and there are certain things I am skeptical of as I research it. But I think, and you've been in this field a lot longer than I have, when you look at people that do good research, whether it's in UFOs or whatever, they approach it with a skeptical mind.
Mm-hmm.
You have to if you're going to be neutral in your results.
Yeah, but it's just like science. Skepticism is not a problem. It's still keeping that open mind. And like you said, you know, there are a lot of people who will debunk individuals as well without even talking to those individuals.
Exactly.
And that's frustrating. It looks like we have a caller. Let's talk to him. And then as much of the real tangible evidence that you found, we could talk about that after this.
Sure.
But let's hear what this caller has to say. Hello, caller. Are you on the air?
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
My name is John. I'm from Brunswick, Maine, and I'm the owner of Paranormal51.com. I don't know if you remember me. I've called in before. But I wanted to know if you felt that the Roswell crash had any veracity to it, if you felt that the reports as well as all the the officiated evidence scattered across the newspapers, if you felt that it was a disinformation campaign, or if you felt that it was a the call is for your guest, and if you felt that if it carried any validity to it at all, if you felt that anything regarding the Roswell crash was had any truth in it.
Oh, I firmly believe that there was a UFO incident at Roswell, and I think Stan Friedman, who's researched that since 1978, has made that point and proven that if that's appropriate. I mean, like Suzanne said, we don't have a lug nut off the thing, or we don't have a chunk of Roswell or Aztec, but if you look at the I think the only disinformation campaign that took place in both Roswell and Aztec were done by the Air Force, not by civilian researchers by any means. I mean, we have the Project Mogul, which is a laughing joke. We have the dummies that they tried to present, saying we're going to be the alien bodies that must have traveled through time, because they didn't use those until the 50s. So I think the only disinformation has come out of the Air Force, not the civilian researchers.
Someone has a question from the chat that's a good question. And, you know, I think it was three out of the four crashes Scully had talked about, and now Roswell. Why are all these crashes in New Mexico? And I think you have some info in that, right?
I think Suzanne and I did a whole chapter on that question.
Uh-huh.
I'll give you the brief on that one. First of all, I don't think they crashed. I think they were shot down.
Mm.
I find it hard to believe that they can go from wherever they come from to here and simply crash.
Mm-hmm.
Now, technology does breed disasters. We've seen that in our own space program. We've had two shuttles we've lost. I think the big question is, look at NUCO and what was going on there from pre-World War II, post-World War II era, and look at all the research and development that was going on in New Mexico, Sandia National Labs, Kirkland, Los Alamos, of course, let's focus it on Roswell, Army Air Force, Army Airfield, the 509th Bomber Group, the only nuke bomb group that we had, the folks that dropped the two bombs on Japan, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think if there was entities from wherever they come from that were interested in to see biologies of what these people on this planet had, knowing that probably with their observing us that we had just had a great world war. Let's see what they're up to. We just detonated in 1945, what, July, at Trinity Site. I might be off on my date. The first test nuke bomb to make sure the ones that we were going to drop on Japan operated. I'm sure that looked like a big cube from, if they're from outer space. But it's also, you look at the amount of restricted airspace that was in New Mexico at the time. I have a map from the Air Force that shows all the shaded areas of restricted airspace. And for the sixth largest state as far as territory, it was, today it's only the 20th or 21st as far as population. So if you were going to look at somebody's technology, New Mexico would be the place to do it. And if you were getting too close to something, an installation, a test site, and you didn't heed to the warnings back in that time frame, you were going to get shot down. And I think that's what happened at Aztec.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scully had talked about a magnetic type of radar system that they had used, and I think they even talked about that being responsible for the crash. And I know you had made some discoveries around that program.
Mm-hmm. We found a couple of the radar bases. One in particular that I think plays a part in the time frame is the original radar base at Alfada Lake. And it was there from 46 to 50. And the remains of the air base or the radar base that we found years later was not actually operational in 48. That was not open until 50. And closed in 57, and they were replaced with what they called a dew-line radar. But the Alvado Dam site, where there was actually a radar base at the dam, as opposed to the one that we talked about, especially in the documentary Aztec 1948, they had what they called the powerful lash-up radar. And I could go on for 3 hours about that. It'd probably confuse your audience. They were playing with an experimental radar. As a matter of fact, I have the manual here at the house.
Wow.
On the do's and don'ts of operating it. And one is, you do not operate it if there are aircraft in the area.
Mm.
And without going into great detail about radar, the old radars had a range finder, a height finder, and what they called a SCAT or a system scan where they would scan the area. And the new lash-up, which was actually being designed for the Navy out at sea, was just a very powerful microwave, which most all radar is, that would scan the horizon looking for anything metallic. And we do know from the records we declassified and the man got that they were experimenting with that radar in the area. Alfado is only 120 miles as the crow flies east of Aztec.
And that was I've got that documentary, Aztec 1948, where you guys are walking through one of these bases, and there were some people that were skeptical that those programs even existed before you proved that they did. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, actually, we found the radar base on a cold, snowy January day. We found that we're pretty sure we found the base the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it snowed 8 inches that night, so we could go up there and hike through snow. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
We actually photographed and mapped the base, and I went down to Maxwell Air Force Base Archives. That's the Air Force Archives. And we had done a previous search looking for radar bases and couldn't find them. And I went down and I laid the photographs on their desk and said, here it is. And what had happened was, since the Atomic Energy Commission had possession of those bases and then handed them over to the Air Force starting 1950, they got kind of lost in the archives between Atomic Energy Commission and the Air Force. But we found all three. And actually, Scully talks about two in the book, and they talk about, not to confuse them with our research, because there is a gap, about Alamogordo, which is south, and Los Alamos. But the interesting thing, that original radar base at Alvado was called the Los Alamos Radar Facility.
Oh, interesting.
Then it was called the Tia Amaria Radar Facility, and then later the Alvado 767th ACNW Radar Facility.
Mm-hmm.
So at one time, it did hold the name Los Alamos Radar Facility.
How interesting. Now, I wanted to ask you also, what was the first piece of evidence you came across that really wowed you and that you, you know, that...
There's so many. I don't know where to start.
Uh-huh.
Why don't you give me a region of
maybe let's say document.
I guess we could probably go back to the radar bases because mm-hmm. they had kept a file on UFOs, which I poured through. I heard Suzanne tell you we have about 7,500 documents here, and
mm-hmm.
I think by the time the book's written, there'll be more. And after the book's written, we'll either find out if some researcher like Frank Warren wants to categorize all these or warehouse, or we're going to have a big bonfire. But in pouring through those old documents, I was amazed that not only, and we'll take the Alvado radar base, for instance, how concerned they were about UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that one document that really cracks me up, we have it, it'll be in the book scanned in, it reminds the intelligence people at the radar base that UFO sightings go up to the 4602 AISS, Air Intelligence Service Squadron at Ent Air Force Base, not to Project Blue Book, as we know that that is nothing more than a publicity.
Oh, really? The document says that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's in one of their historical journals, their monthly report. It was a publicity something being put on by the Air Force.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And I looked at that, and I thought, well, at least they finally admitted it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's so many documents, and not all the documents we have are a smoking gun to Aztec, but they're supportive documents for other documents,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. It's you know, you've got the CIA following the Aztec case. You have the FBI. Of course, there's OSI. You have the Army Counterintelligence Division. So there wasn't just one group that looked at Aztec, wrote it off after a few weeks and said, oh, okay, well, we got a report of a downed UFO. There's nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
Those documents, I would have probably been done with the Aztec case in a matter of years.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like much time goes by and we find something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been denied a lot, too.
Yeah.
I mean, case in point with Silas Newton, which we have, I think the count is 289 documents from the FBI on Silas.
Wow.
That doesn't cover the 180-some we were denied.
Wow.
Some of the documents we have are 80-90% blacked out.
On Silas?
On Silas Newton.
Wow.
And Silas Newton being a main character in the Aztec story with Frank Scully, I'd love to see the 180-some that we were denied.
Right.
I mean, if they're going to block out 80% of one document, you know, what about the ones we can't see?
Yeah. You know, not a lot of people about the Aztec New Mexico crash from 48 or know a lot about it. That's why I'm excited about your work, the documentary Aztec 1948, and your book. I can't wait for the book. But as PC, there's so much to it here, and I wish we had more time to talk about more. But we've all only got a few minutes, and before you're done, you know, I was amazed one time I met you at a MUFON conference, and I asked you
about... Yeah, we met in Denver, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You bought me a drink.
That's what I told Suzanne. That's how I remembered you.
And I had asked you about Dulce, because it's not too far from that area, and asked if you had checked that out. And amazingly, you said that you had checked it out. You found some things there I had never heard before that I think are an important part of the Dulce puzzle.
Yeah, I think they're an important part to the Dulce puzzle, but I think all the folks that are Dulce fans out there that might want to believe that there might be an alien base there or something, and I know we're getting toward the end of the show, so I'll make it quick. I went up almost on a dare because people were telling me you could not get to the top of the mesa. And I've never seen a mesa or a fence I couldn't climb. No, actually, we got up there illegally. I'm not going to – you have to be extremely careful to get there because you either have to cross the Apache Jicarilla Reservation or the Southern Ute. And there is a fine if you're caught up there on the way to the mesa. The actual mesa of the mesa is owned by the Bureau of Land Management. But that said, we've been up there on two separate occasions and camped. To me, Dulce is nothing more than an old mining project that started in the 50s. We have found many, three railroad tunnels going into the mountain. We have found probably four more that we can't get to.
Mm-hmm.
All the old railroad trestle locked down. The project is public. If people want to do the digging, it was to hollow out the mountain and store nuke waste from Sandy and Los Alamos. And in the interest of time on your show, it looks like there became a bureaucratic fight over whether it was going to be state or federal funding. And at the end of the day, everybody walked away from the project. There is also a narrow gauge, an old narrow gauge rail line that runs from Lumberton, Dulce, to Mashio, and that's no longer there. There's parts and a little actual museum part of it when you come into the town of Dulce. They have some old cattle cars sitting there. But I think at the end of the day, Dulce is a good campfire story. They left mining equipment up on top of the mesa. Old mining cars, old rail cars. I would think that if one was going to build a top secret base, they would think about removing the old rail cars.
Yeah, you know, I've been looking, that's why I asked you, I've been looking into Dulce for a while. I've lived in Colorado my whole life, been down to the San Luis Valley a lot, New Mexico, spent a lot of time in that area. It's my favorite area in the country. And I have been skeptical of Dulce also, so I've been looking a lot into that. And if people look into, you know, the Dulce stuff, everything we've gotten so far is hearsay. So
oh, that's right.
And anybody who's gone down to try to do some real research has not found any, so.
And very few people really have gone to Dulce to do research.
Yeah.
The only reason I would go there.
Uh-huh.
What was that?
Oh, that was a little voice telling us we have 90 seconds.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you really can't get there from here. I go from Farmington to through Dulce to get to Los Alamos because I was calling on Los Alamos National Lab, so I kind of really had to go right by it.
Yeah.
But beautiful part of the country. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
That wouldn't discourage me or any of your guests to go there and just
definitely
enjoy Dulce.
Yeah, it is beautiful. But as you can the lady telling us in our ear, we're out of time. You can go to Aztec1948.com. Is that right? To go get some more information?
Yep, and you can buy the hour-long documentary that is advertised on the site or buy it through UFOTV.com.
Yep, and it's great. I've got a copy. You've got to check it out. And then I also, you know, thanks to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, which also syndicates this show. Thank you very much, Scott and Suzanne, for being on the show. Great information. And we will talk to everybody again. Remember, Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll be called Open Minds Radio, and we'll start up with openminds.tv. So thank you, Scott, and you have a lovely remainder of your weekend.
Thanks so much. We appreciate it.